This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Eli Gottlieb has come down here from New York to talk about his book, Best Boy. It's an award-winning book, and it's one you'll never forget. What's the book about, Eli?
Well, always a difficult question. This book, at least on the surface, is about a middle-aged man suffering from autism who has spent his life in a therapeutic community and who has a crisis precipitated by the arrival of a new staffer who resembles his feared, now dead father. And on the heels of that crisis, he decides he needs to return home to a home that no longer exists.
And so one of the themes might be, what is home? And that is brought out beautifully, I think. Eli Gottlieb at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. It won the Bridge Award, among other things. And so why do you think it won the international award to be translated into Italian and circulated globally? What do you think they saw?
It's interesting. When a foreigner looks at America, they see a very different thing than we see. In the end, it's a bit of a mystery to me. I'm obviously very gratified that they chose it. I have a long history with Italy. I lived in the country almost a decade. And for that reason, it was doubly gratifying to be chosen. But I think that one of the things that I was impressed by was that the language in the book was the product of a long process of distillation, and it seems on the surface to be written simply. I did that quite intentionally as a way to mimic the thought processes of somebody for whom language was a challenge, a man suffering from autism. What impressed me, what surprised me in a way, was that the Italians were able to see below the apparent simplicity of the surface to the complexity below.
And we should explain that the Bridge Award is sponsored by the American Initiative for Italian Culture and the Literature House in Rome, among a consortium of Italian dignitaries, and it's hosted by the embassy here in Washington. Tonight you'll be on a panel about this book. But I think it is, as you say, very interesting that the kind of language that you use was perceived and understood. This is a very lyrical book. This is why you're on The Poet and the Poem, because it is it's poetic prose. But the language, through the eyes of Todd, your protagonist, is luminous and poetry. So let us hear a little bit of this book. Eli Gottlieb, who has won the Bridge Award, and we'll give you a taste of The Best Boy.
Everybody thinks they know what's wrong with me, but they don't. They think I'm autistic, but they don't exactly know what that means either. A doctor named Eugene Bleuler made up the word autism in 1911, though it didn't get used on anybody until a long time later. The last name of Bleuler sounds like it might belong to a fat man who's bursting out of his clothes with a pop. But actually, he was a Swiss doctor with a mustache who was good with words because he also made up the one schizophrenia. After Eugene Bleuler, no one thought about autism for a while because of being distracted by world wars. But then starting in the 1940s, one person after another began explaining that they knew what autism was and you should let them tell you. Not only do I sometimes read the paper, I also read the Encyclopedia Britannica too. No one knows that either, even though I have it under my bed. My mama first brought me the encyclopedia when I was 12 years old. I had just arrived at the Clovis Center, and she asked the director there to make a, quote, special exception. He said yes, and so have all the other directors since. She used to bring me the Britannica yearbooks each year or two until she died, mama. Most people think the encyclopedia is there to make me happy, like a piece of blanket from childhood, but I actually read it lots because the encyclopedia has a voice that belongs to a man sitting in a room at a table who wants to calmly talk about every single thing in the world, and it calms me to hear that. It calms me how he never gets angry or sick or makes the dog growl in his chest. Mm. It calms me that he only waits patiently for you to turn the page so he can start talking again. I told Ray Keen about him, and she laughed and said she was going to call the Britannica Mr. B. Now, whenever I ask her a question she doesn't know the answer to, she says, "Why don't you ask Mr. B?" When I asked him, Mr. B said that the explaining about autism has gone on for a while and continued till today, and still no one knows exactly what it is. He said this is true, even though scientists are having all sorts of what he calls groundbreaking discoveries about autism. He says they're doing a lot of tying of autism to things in the environment when they're not doing groundbreaking. Meanwhile, there are the skulls. I like thinking about the skulls. They're kept in museums in places like Germany and France, and they're shiny because they've been painted with varnish by museum people to keep them from rotting in air, which is called oxidation. The skulls are from a period of long ago known as the Neolithic. Mr. B said that this was when groups of people first began having fun together, 8,000 years ago. He says they played string instruments, baked bread, and kept pets. He says they did things with their hair to look good for each other. The skulls have little holes cut in them. These holes are often square. Sometimes the cuts are perfect, like the lines of a tic-tac-toe. They were probably made with a curved knife. Also, the holes have bone growth around them, which means the surgery was done on people who were still alive. The question is, why? Why'd they do it? Who was the first person who said, "I know, I'll feel better when I cut a hole in my head"? No one knows the answer for sure, but Mr. B said that it's probably the first example ever in the whole world of someone being operated on by someone else to let the crazy out.
Eli Gottlieb at the Library of Congress. That's his main character. What's his name?
Todd Aaron.
Yes, and you can see that there's a correlation between autism and high IQ.
Absolutely.
Yes. And that's one thing, one breakthrough thing you're showing in this book. So how, at what moment did you know that you were going to start this magnificent obsession where you had to tell his story?
Well, that's a question with more of a backstory to it than you may realize. My only sibling is autistic, and he's an older brother. And I grew up with him in the dark ages of autism of the 1960s, where the diagnostic situation was really rudimentary. And he was kept at home against the advice of doctors. So I grew up with a firsthand experience of real massive dysfunction and disability. And my defense against that, to answer your question, was that as a very young child, I began writing stories about my family because I understood somehow, intuitively, that what was happening to me was not normal. This was not a normal childhood. This was not the childhood I read about in books and magazines that other people had. And my response, as I say, was to try to put it into words because I was good with language. So from the very earliest, I began writing stories about my brother and my family, and in a way, this has been a 40-year obsession.
However, that doesn't tell us the special quality it takes for you to get inside of the mind of such a person and imagine the sensibilities, which you are, as I say, the only word is luminous, because the thoughts that Todd has are pure poetry. The world is clear, there are frightening things in it, but you show me for the first time what it feels like. No, everyone else knows what it looks like and what it sounds like and what they tell us, but you really show us what it feels like. So that is where, luckily, you were a writer, because just to describe your brother would not have done it.
Well, in fact, that's exactly to the point. What I wanted to try to do was place language inside the black box of autism. People don't know what is inside autism, and autism in a way repels language. So the challenge was to try to use the flashlight of words to illuminate this dark space and to use the chain, the traction that narrative gives to pull myself and my readers into that world. It took a tremendous amount of work to find the strangeness inside the language. And I originally wrote a lot of the book in the second person. The second person, the you form of address, is useful, I found it useful, for mapping the oddness of the narrator's perception. And once I got deeply into the book using that second person, I then rewrote it in the first person.
Oh, that's so interesting. How many years did it take?
4 years of daily work.
Daily work. Yeah. But talking about all the characters, there's not only this truly silky prose and startling moments, but there are characters, there's plot, there's situation. And tell us about the characters in Todd's life that make him sustain what he must endure. Mm. The loving presence, his caretaker. Is it Ray Keane?
Ray Keane.
The memory of his mama.
Right.
So you have these golden threads going through the book that sustain him. Do you believe that that's true with many people or just lucky people?
Well, that's a tricky question. I think that, well, let me just back up. I grew up going to therapeutic communities because that's where my brother was sent at age 11. And my mother made advocating for my brother the center of her life. As often happens with a disabled child, the mother and the child bond, kind of a nuclear fusion between the two of them, and everybody else in the family gets relegated to the suburbs, including the husband and the other siblings. But in this case, the Ray Keane character is a compilation of the real people that I saw on the front line helping my brother, incredibly selfless and loving individuals, I have to say, unsung, underpaid, playing a crucial role in bettering the quality of life of these people who are essentially helpless. On the other hand, there is often a remarkable, as I started to say earlier, a remarkable connection between the disabled child and the mom. So the fact that the narrator would have that kind of primary, passionate memory of the mother and be upheld by his direct care staff is not really a stretch.
In this book, there are many cases where the mother rejects such a child. Don't you agree?
In life. Oh, yeah. No, there are.
Yeah. So this is significant because I think of your paradigm on this particular boy's life. And I think it would be time to read some more.
Happily.
Remind everyone that this is Best Boy by Eli Gottlieb at the Library of Congress.
My parents seemed to live forever, but after they finally got very small and old and died, my younger brother Nate became my guardian. He lives with his wife and two sons in a house just up the street from the home we grew up in, which is 744.7 miles east of Peyton Living Center, beyond the mountains. I haven't been to the house, but he sent me pictures. It's a brick house with a big lawn. In one of the pictures, a dog is running in crazy circles on the grass. In another, a cat crouches, sneaking. If I look close in the background, I can see a sprinkler raising a claw of water. These photos are tacked over my bed. But I've taken a pen and blacked out the faces of the animals. I can't explain why they frighten me so much, but they do. Pets belong to the same category as typewriters that are filled with millipede arms which wave up and down to hit the paper, and cash registers with drawers that open like laughing mouths, with bills where their tongues should be, and flashing numbers for eyes. Nate comes and sees me when he can. He always says, "See you very soon," but then a long time goes by and everyone forgets, and it's 6 months later. Other villagers have family who live nearby and come almost every weekend. They have mothers and fathers who arrive in cars filled with the shattering glass sounds of children laughing and also sometimes picnic baskets and gifts. These families have outdoor meals in the rinks of shade beneath the trees on the Peyton lawns. They go with their villagers to the Craswick Zoo where you can wear glasses and a mask and a llama will spit at you for money. They take them out for ice cream and visit the Lawndale Arboretum, where the flower smells are so strong, everything you eat afterwards tastes like an iris, including steaks or French fries or even a chocolate malted. When Nate comes, we always go to the big chrome Pilgrim Diner, which is near Peyton, and order the same thing. He asks me questions about myself and tries his best to be interested in everything I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we also do is make sure never to talk about how much we hated each other when we were boys. We pretend just like Mom always said that, quote, at bottom, the Aaron guys always pulled together. Nate often has a drink like a gin and tonic in his hand as he says this and pushes the drink into the air at me in a kind of toast, even though I can't have alcohol because of my meds. One of the specific things we don't talk about is April 13th, 1968. That's the day I kicked Mama to the ground outside the ShopRite supermarket in Taunton, New Jersey. I was 11 and attacking her from inside a case of terrible Volts. The police came. People stood around with their mouths open in little scoops of darkness. Behind them, big blue-red banners in the ShopRite windows announced a special on star-kissed tuna at half price. Nate sat in the car, watching, and I think maybe he was smiling. We don't talk about the next day either, when the bruises on Mama's face from my shoes were hidden under powder, and she stood with my brother and me in the parking lot of a doctor's office, brushing my coat with her hands, holding me by the pointy twists of the shoulders, and whispering that I should be a brave boy and a good soldier. This is nothing, she said, pushing me forward with her hand in the middle of my back. We'll be home in a jiffy, and then everything will be just like it was.
Wow. When did you know you had the character, you had the feelings, you knew what you wanted to do? When did you know that you had to introduce a plot with suspense and apprehension? And how did you come upon the idea of Mike the Apron?
Well, I've been at this for a long time, and I know that interesting observations and lovely prose really only carry the reader about a page, if that, and what is needed is tension, and what is needed is a polarity that causes people to be involved in finding out what happens next. To be more specific in answer to your question, I don't actually know how I managed to create a plot and characters. It's really alchemical. It really is a question of me just writing and rewriting and rewriting and discovering what I'm doing while backing up away from the vehicle.
But you knew you had to have a bad guy, right?
I knew that I needed to have something that kind of quickened the situation, that precipitated a crisis. But that happened after I felt like I was deep enough in the character of Todd himself so that he could walk around in his world and have things happen to him.
Yes. And there is the possibility that in every living facility, there could be someone whose intentions are not excellent.
That's absolutely the case in real life.
There
are a lot of lawsuits. Typically, it's negligence on the part of staff rather than outright malevolence, but there's also malevolence and there's also sexual abuse.
Yes. Read us some more. Eli Gottlieb, Best Boy.
Sometimes, to help me in my conversations with Mr. B, I do an internet search. Most people don't know I can do that either, but Ray Keene does. She says I can use it as part of our, quote, special understanding. She calls the computer Mr. C. She says, "You asking Mr. B or Mr. C for that information?" Then she laughs and shakes her head. Mr. C doesn't make me calm like Mr. B does. Mr. C, the computer, makes fizzing electric noises from the work of hauling information in from all around the world. He says that no one knows when autism started, but that people were autistic long before the word was invented. Mr. C has lists of some of these people. He likes lists. He likes stacking information in piles. He says that maybe people possessed by demons were autistic, along with the monks of the Middle Ages who gave away everything, spoke in strange tongues, and cried when animals were hurt. He says that maybe the Yorodivi, which is the word for holy fools, were autistic, along with a woman named Pelagia Serebrennikova, who threw stones into a flooded pit and pulled them out one by one and repeated the process until she grew weak for years. Then there was Wild Peter. In 1723, says Mr. C., a naked boy was seen running along the edge of the Weser River in the town of Hameln, Germany. When the fishermen saw him through the trees, they lowered their nets in astonishment and said German words to one another in their surprise that such a person could exist. Soon the boy was captured sucking milk from a cow and brought to a farmer's house. He was very small, but he moved fast through the woods on his hands and knees. Like the wind, local people said. Like a squirrel, some said. Like a goat, said others. But he couldn't speak a word. No one could understand how he'd lived through the cold German winters. The boy wouldn't talk, and he ate only nuts, onions, and potatoes. He had no name, but people started calling him Wild Peter, and he soon became a famous person in Germany. Then he was brought to London, where the crowds gathering to see him were huge. One of the people who saw him there was a man named Jonathan Swift. But Peter wasn't interested in what people thought, whether they were Jonathan Swift or King George. The king invited him to his home in London to meet his friends, but during dinner that night he got volts, tore off all his clothes, ate the food from other people's plates, and then escaped out the window before being captured in a tree in the public gardens. After that he was sent to live on a farm in the British countryside. Wild Peter finally became one of the most famous people in all of Europe, but he wasn't interested in that either. He loved music and humming and rocking in place. He loved standing outside in the farmyard with the sun on his skin or at night watching the stars. He loved drinking gin. He never learned to speak more than a few words, but when an important judge came to see him when Peter was already an old man, he entertained the judge by slowly singing a song he'd memorized over the years. It went like this. Of all the girls in our town, the red, the black, the fair, the brown, that dance and prance it up and down, there's none like Nancy Dawson. Then he died.
An interesting part of your book is the friendship that Todd has with Martina. And I think that's really an important moment because that it could happen, that something changed in him, that all things are possible, and what made you feel that that touch was needed?
It evolved somewhat out of the desire to give this person a credible life in the round, and the truth of the matter is that in these therapeutic communities, the congregate housing, as it's called, there are often relationships, and they're very, very important. People with Down syndrome, for example, are powerfully erotic often.
And marry many marriages.
Absolutely, absolutely. And my brother, in his own true life, very much wanted a girlfriend for a long time. And I also felt like I just wanted to write a badass female character. And so for people who haven't read the book, she arrives at this facility. She is much higher functioning than most of the people. And she is a bit of a rabble-rouser. And she convinces Todd to go off his meds, which is something that for someone who is autistic, typically people with autism, I mean, again, it's dangerous to generalize, especially now, because due to a variety of reasons, the word has come to signify a vast sum of different conditions. But people with autism are often very rule-bound. My brother is a perfect case in point in that. And I stress that in the book, afraid of breaking the rules. The idea of not taking his meds is astonishing to Todd. He's never even been able to conceive of such a thing. Under her influence and the fact that he's mesmerized by her, he does. And that, if you read the novel, has a whole cascade of consequences.
Not good at some point. But I love the moment of intimacy where she has one eye, where she lets him touch her wet, moist eye. And that's that moment. It's almost a sexual moment, right. Where she allows him to do the most vulnerable thing possible. So you went many places in this book. And
yeah.
Your first book was on the same theme.
My first book was another, sort of the companion volume to this in a way. That was the story of the same family, essentially, but from the point of view of a 12-year-old sibling of a brother with autism. If you read them side by side, you will see the same group of individuals, some of them alive and some of them dead.
I will. And it won the American Academy of Arts and Letters Rome Prize. And that was your premier book.
Yes.
Yes. So there were 20 years between books.
Yes, there were. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing is that both of them were published by the same editor, even though in the intervening years, I had other novels published by different editors. But one guy is connected to both of these books, which are the most personal and hard-won of the novels.
And the Italians love you, obviously, because two Italian international prizes for two books.
Well, the first one was done by an American jury. It sent me to Italy, though.
Yes, well, tell me what happens with the Bridge Award. You're getting it translated, or has it been?
It's been translated, but it hasn't come out yet. It's coming out in Italy in January with a wonderful press. They're called Minimum Facts, remarkably, one of those strange jokes of international, you know, English usage. And I'm thrilled.
And will you go?
I don't know yet. It's up in the air, but I was happy to be able to participate in the translation a little bit.
Oh, really?
And I myself have translated a bunch of books from English, from Italian to English. I wouldn't dare translate a book from English to Italian, but I was able to give a little bit of collaborative advice to the translator.
Well, so you're literate in both languages. That is very good. So at the embassy, you'll shine tonight among the English authors.
Let's hope.
Yes, and you're going to be in a panel, which is honoring you again. What are you working on now?
It's interesting because both of these books dealing with the family kind of knocked me off my pedestal and made it very, very hard for me to go on to the next book. The two books between them were more sort of exercises in genre fiction, if you want, and I was easily able to pivot from them into the next book. These, because they came from so deep down, and this one in particular because I think it involves living inside this damaged consciousness, has been really hard to get away from. So I'm finally moving into another book, and that book is dedicated to the exploration of male friendship.
This book has been cited for goodness and love and hope. Those aren't bad things in literature. This is Eli Gottlieb's voice. We're at the Library of Congress, and The Poet and the Poem is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support by Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue and Candace Katz. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.